May it please the court, my name is Daniel Vinson, and I'm counsel for the appellant Joseph Maurice McFadden. At its heart, this is a constructive possession case.
Counsel, excuse me, why? The officers testified that the appellant had the jeans on, saw him with the jeans on, took the jeans off, put the jeans on top of the bed, picked up the jeans, and found the contraband. Why is that not an active possession case?
Well, there are, I guess, several key facts that would support my argument that it's a constructive possession as opposed to an actual possession case. The first being, of the five witnesses that were offered by the Commonwealth, Lieutenant Joyner, Correctional Officer Taylor, Lieutenant Petty, Correctional Officer Fields, and Special Agent Peters, of the four that were present, Joyner, Taylor, Petty, and Fields, none of them could recall whether or not there were other items of clothing that were actually on the top bunk.
But you left out one witness that wasn't the Commonwealth's witness, and that's Mr. Spruill.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Spruill, I believe on direct examination, confirmed that the pair of jeans that was pulled off the bed was the pair of jeans he had been wearing. And in fact, on page 8 of your brief, you concede that your argument would be weaker if you could establish those were the jeans he was wearing, and it seems Mr. Spruill provides sufficient evidence for the fact finder to conclude that that's true.
Yes, sir.
Given that and your concession that your argument would be substantially weaker if that fact was in the record, and that fact is in the record, where are we?
Well, the only thing I would say in response to that is that fact is not in the record after, in terms of the Commonwealth's own evidence.
Does that matter?
Given, I think, under a motion to strike, what you're assessing is the evidence in totality, for this court, likely not. But I would say that there are other facts that are in the record that, with or without Mr. Spruill's testimony, if we're looking at this as an actual possession argument, kind of brings it back to shades of gray, in my opinion.
And shades of gray are a bad place to be when you're the appellant.
I understand, Your Honor. But I think it can't be overlooked that the nature of the substance, Suboxone, by the Commonwealth's own evidence, by two particular witnesses, Petty, namely, didn't have any idea what it was. And the Correctional Officer Fields, who is the special investigative officer who is to determine these sorts of contraband that's found, mischaracterized it in her own testimony as synthetic marijuana, and that's not what it is.
So, in our decision in Sierra, we basically said it doesn't matter if the person knows the specific nature of the controlled substance, or as long as they know it's a controlled substance. And so your argument that people may have thought it was a different controlled substance doesn't seem to negate the possibility that the person who had it in his jeans pocket knew he had drugs.
True, Your Honor, and I guess maybe that particular case that you cited may not be directly applicable here because this wasn't coming off of the defendant's mischaracterization. It was the Commonwealth's own evidence, and I think it also can't be overlooked in the manner in which it was found. It was found in the Suboxone, and I don't recall exactly how well this is described in the record, but they're small strips, to my understanding, that are meant to be ingested orally and to dissolve on the tongue. They were contained in folded pieces of paper that were contained in an oatmeal packet that were found in these jeans that the defendant did claim and that were found on his bunk and that ultimately Mr. Spruill testified were the ones that he was wearing. But there is one key piece of evidence that I think my entire argument hinges on, and that came from Fields' own testimony as Commonwealth's witness that inmates borrow clothing from each other. So I think given the manner in which the substance was packaged together with that evidence brings the argument closer to constructive possession in that there still needs to be proof that the defendant is aware of the presence of the substance.
Go ahead.
Counsel, I have two questions for you. The first question is, I'm looking at your assignment of error. The trial court committed reversible error because the court found sufficient evidence that defendant possessed a Schedule III substance. Now, I've read your motion to strike argument, and I've read your restatement of your motion to strike, basically your concluding argument, and I've read your brief, and it seems to me that the focus of all of this has been on the question of whether this was constructive versus active possession. And is that the case? And moreover, would you address the Commonwealth's argument that this is a strict liability statute?
Taking those questions in turn, in terms of the constructive versus active possession argument, I circle back to the responses that I had given to Your Honors previously, that with the evidence of the substance being in the jeans, and with in tandem with Mr. Sproul's testimony, even though it wasn't the Commonwealth's witness, would again lend it to be, as you pointed out, actual possession. But I don't think it's that simple, because I still think that the knowing and intentional is required, and
well,
that
you
kind
agree
of
that knowing and potential isn't part of the language of the statute, correct?
I do, Your Honor.
And you cite Young,
yes, sir,
which is the
yes,
general
ma'am.
Possession statute, which does include that language.
Yes, ma'am. And and this goes into your question in relation to the Commonwealth's brief, in terms of that the statute has no mens rea requirement. And after reading the Heron case, which I believe was cited pretty heavily in the Commonwealth's brief, I'll concede that it does say that 53.1203 does not require proof of specific intent, and that it characterizes the statute as a strict liability offense. And it gets there through a de novo review of the statutory construction of this particular statute. But I think it's important to back up to one of the key principles to statutory construction, which is noted in the Heron opinion, is that you don't want a statutory construction to lead to absurd results.
I recognize that Heron dealt with a slightly different subsection of the statute, but the language is the same in the two. Effectively, the relevant language is effectively the same in the statute. Is there any basis for us to conclude that for this subsection of the statute, the rule of Heron wouldn't apply?
Well, I would pose a hypothetical, and it backs me.
Generally, we do that, but go ahead.
I'll pose a hypothetical with an answer, I would say, Your Honor. And it backs me up to the, you want to avoid having absurd results in terms of a statutory construction of criminal statutes. If, under the Commonwealth's interpretation of the statute, we have the exact same scenario. There is a search of an inmate cell. There are two cellmates there. There is one cellmate in possession of contraband that the officers see. His cellmate is in front of him, and he slips the contraband into the back pocket of his cellmate. And under the Commonwealth's interpretation of the statute, then both of them would be guilty.
Is that the Commonwealth's interpretation of the statute or this court's interpretation in Heron? I mean, I guess my question is, I understand what you've said, and it makes a good deal of sense, and you would hope if it violates the statute, there would be some prosecutorial discretion probably applied. But what you just said for the subsection involved in Heron, wouldn't that also be true, given our interpretation of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it would, but I would direct...
Isn't that interpretation of the statute binding upon us?
I don't think so. And the reason I suggest that I don't think so, Your Honor, I would direct your attention to a Walker v. Commonwealth case, which is an unpublished opinion, but it cites the law that I want to get to is published opinion from this court that was done en banc. And the case, the Walker case, is record number 2509-05-1. And they cite the Castaneda v. Commonwealth case, which is 7 Virginia Appellate 574. And the language that I'm pointing to, it says, to convict a person of possessing contraband, the Commonwealth must prove that the defendant was aware of the presence and character of the contraband and that he intentionally and consciously possessed it.
What was the statute involved in that case?
53.1203 subsection 4 as opposed to subsection 6 that's before Your Honor. And that particular subsection 4 involves an instrument capable of causing death, essentially some sort of knife or bladed object was the instrument at issue in that particular case. So, circling back, I understand the court's ruling in Heron, and it makes sense in the context of that particular case, but in light of Walker, as I cited, which was citing Castaneda.
You are in your rebuttal time. You can use it however you want.
Yes, Your Honor. I think in light of that, that gives this court here today the option of, I don't think it's as clear-cut and as binding as reading the Commonwealth's brief at first glance would suggest. I think that there is room under these previous decisions to, when the facts warrant such, have an analysis that's based on a knowing and intentional element, not necessarily reading it into the statute, but again, it presents a circumstance where absurd results can be avoided.
Where did you argue knowing and intentional?
On page 6 of my brief.
No, I'm talking about a trial.
At trial? I thought that I had argued that in tandem with a constructive possession argument at the motion to strike, but I can't say that for sure. I'd have to review the appendix. And at this point, given the time that I have left, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
That might be a good thing to look for
yes,
while she's talking. Good morning, Ms. Yates.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Yates on behalf of the Commonwealth. Mr. McFadden was convicted of being a prisoner in possession of a Schedule III controlled substance. And Mr. McFadden's first argument is that there is no evidence or insufficient evidence that he knew that the substance in question was Suboxone and was aware of its nature and character. However, this is a strict liability offense. As this court determined with another subsection, as articulated in the Heron case.
But didn't Heron also say that nevertheless you had to prove some kind of intent, and they came up with the concept of voluntary act?
No, Your Honor. Voluntary act is something I think that was articulated in the Esteban case.
Yeah.
And there the Supreme Court of Virginia was asked to address an argument that for due process reasons, for someone to be convicted of a criminal offense, there must be some voluntary act that someone committed in order to convict them. And in that case, the court held, and it relied on arguments made in other jurisdictions, that the voluntary act is coming into a prison under those facts or coming into a school zone with that substance. So the issue was whether someone did something with that to show that there's a voluntary act. And under the hypothetical raised by my opposing counsel today, no, that second prisoner would not be able to be convicted under even a strict liability offense unless there was some voluntary act. And I think that might be the issue in that case. But
isn't Esteban somewhat suspect because of the interpretation that it made of Morissette?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with a distinction made in Morissette that might otherwise invalidate the idea that the General Assembly is allowed to omit terms where it chooses. And this was not an offense at common law. This is a purely statutory offense. And where the legislature has omitted certain elements, there's presumption that it did so intentionally.
And the legislature, in fact, did amend the statute that was issued in Esteban, correct?
Your Honor, I am not certain. I apologize. If they did that, then the legislature is certainly entitled to do that. And after Heron, if the legislature did not agree with this court's interpretation of its statute, it certainly had the ability to amend it.
If you agree that in counsel's hypothetical, where your cellmate slips it into your pocket, that you have not committed a voluntary act and therefore have not violated the statute, what evidence, both in the abstract, would the Commonwealth have to adduce to demonstrate that that scenario is not at play? And then specific to this case, what is the evidentiary hook that takes us out of that hypothetical scenario?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the defendant was observed wearing the jeans in question, and he was observed removing the jeans, and both individuals in the cell were watched the entire time. The defendant admitted the jeans were his, but denied being aware that the substance was present. And in this case...
Are you arguing that's essentially enough of an inference that we just don't expect people to slip things in our pants pocket and not notice it?
The trial court is only obligated to consider reasonable hypotheses of innocence. And in this case, first, because of the testimony of the officers, the court could consider all of the relevant facts, one of them being the likelihood of someone managing to slip something in someone's pocket they were unaware of. But in this case specifically, the substance was found right next to Mr. McFadden's ID card and right next to his address book that contained his information. And the substance... Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Counsel, again, as I read what happened in the trial court, there was no emphasis on knowing and intentional. The emphasis was on constructive versus actual possession. It was, and that seemed to be the ruling of the trial court. So what is the issue on appeal?
I agree with that characterization, Your Honor. The arguments were made in the trial court about whether there's sufficient evidence that he actually or constructively possessed it, and whether perhaps he was aware that the substance was Suboxone. But otherwise, these arguments were not raised in the motion to strike, and the trial court otherwise was not fairly given an opportunity to consider any other issues.
And certainly the trial court was never confronted with the issue of this potentially being a strict liability statute.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, Your Honor. Today, for the first time, my opposing counsel cites Walker versus Commonwealth. I reviewed again the appellant's brief and didn't see that cited in the table of authorities. That being said, I do happen to have that case, and there it doesn't seem that the court was presented with an argument, as far as I'm aware, that this was otherwise a strict liability offense. So taking the arguments presented, the court could certainly, in that unpublished opinion, have not been presented with an argument that it should be considered a strict liability offense. The Heron case, however, is published, so distinguish it that way as well. As I stated before, in this case, there's more than just a substance being in someone's pocket. The substance in question was also hidden inside a torn oatmeal packet and folded up strips of paper. This was directly next to the Mr. McFadden's identification and directly next to his address book. And there's more than sufficient evidence for the trial court to have determined that he possessed the item in question. Otherwise, if there are no further questions from the court, I'm happy to rely on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Benson.
And now that I've had a little bit of time to review the record, I would point, Your Honor, to page 44 of the appendix. The motion to strike that was made begins about mid-page. It's in the first paragraph. I argued at trial there's no indication that Mr. McFadden had any information of the character that the substance or its presence of this in this particular pair of pants. So though it may not be phrased in the exact same way, I believe the argument was made, albeit briefly, it was made. And at that point, the argument gets slightly muddy, because at that point, Mr. Sproul had not testified. But at any rate, I think...
Well, that's at the motion to strike at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's evidence. Where that would need to be made again. So where would it be again?
Well, on the... There's some vague language, Your Honor, involving incorporation. I had stated, I guess I'll incorporate this into a renewed motion to strike. I don't know if it explicitly says any further than that, incorporating the motions or the arguments previously made. So, and it focuses again on constructive possession. And I understand that the knowledge of the an intentional and knowledge of the character of the substance is it carries over between constructive and actual possession, and a majority of the argument focused on constructive possession. I'll submit that, but I think it backs us up to the manner in which that the substance was packaged, and that was noted by the Commonwealth. It was in an oatmeal packet that was never introduced, so the court didn't get to ascertain the character of the packet and what condition it was in. That's not contraband. It's not criminalized by this particular statute. That, together with testimony that inmates borrow clothing, I think gets us back into that realm, and I believe that I'm out of time. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll come down and...